Welcome to Literary Quest, a podcast hosted by us, Vicky and Marissa, where we discuss our favorite in fantasy fiction and hopefully can direct you in your quest to find your next great read. Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Literary Quest. Today we'll be discussing Gideon the Ninth by Tamsin Muir. There are a lot of side characters, so I'm not going to name all of them, but I'll briefly discuss our characters and location, and Dickie will read our plot. So one of our main characters is Gideon Nav. She is an 18-year-old female who is orphaned on the planet of the Ninth House, and she is desperate to get off of her planet, hoping to become a soldier, but also just to get away from her nemesis, Harrow Hark Nonagesimus. She is exceedingly talented with sword and learns to become skilled with a rapier. She is snarky and sarcastic and has a lot of attitude and is just generally not here for your bullshit. And then we have Harrow Hark Nonagesimus, who is a 17-year-old female princess of the Ninth House and is a bone necromancer. She is able to reanimate skeletons from small fragments of bone and is one of the strongest necromancers of her age. She is generally cruel to Gideon, consistently thwarts her plans to escape from the planet that they live on, and cultivates mean and painful punishments for Gideon when she does try to run away, until a hero actually needs her skill and force with the sword. Where Gideon is loud and brash with her insults, Harrow is generally cutting with just a few words. So in this world, there are 9 houses, the first belonging to the emperor and the rest belonging to everyone else. In this world, we have necromancers who use different types of magic to manipulate the dead. And it seems that that correlates to whatever planet they live on. So they either manifest or use bone magic, like Harrow from Ninth House, or some of them will siphon souls. Some of them work in the liminal space between life and death. And then others can even just reanimate corpses to the extent that they don't decay. And they seem like people that are really alive. And so these other houses are governed by the emperor of the first house, who is a god, basically, and who uses lictors, or necromancers who are essentially immortal and super powerful to help him carry things out. Yeah. This book takes place in space. We're not given a lot of information about a setting here, but in general, in space, on the planet that belongs to the Ninth House and the First House, where their big challenge is set. Vicky?
Yes. Okay, so in the beginning of the book, Gideon tries to escape from the Ninth House, but is stopped by Harrow. Harrow says that she will release Gideon if she can beat her. However, she plays dirty and uses her bone necromancer skills to defeat Gideon. Gideon ends up getting dragged off to what's essentially a church, where Harrow announces that the Emperor has summoned her to the First House to compete to become a lictor. Harrow tells Gideon that if she comes as her cavalier, then at the end, assuming they don't all die, she will be released. And so Gideon agrees. They head off to the first house, and slowly the other necromancers start to arrive. However, there isn't any camaraderie between them, and Harrow leaves Gideon in their rooms and leaves notes instructing her to stay silent and not to speak to anyone. Gideon sees little of Harrow, but when Harrow is gone for 2 days, she seeks her out. She finds her in a restorative bone cocoon after exhausting herself. Gideon gets Harrow to tell her what she is doing. Harrow reveals that she is finding the keys to doors and completing challenges. The one she is working on has been especially difficult, and Gideon wants to help. There is a bone construct that needs to be defeated, but Harrow's skeletons aren't doing the job. Instead, Gideon goes in and lets herself be controlled by Harrow in order to peel back the necromantic theorems animating the construct. Once it is defeated, they find another key. When they go to leave, however, they find the murdered bodies of the fifth house. All of the necromancers try to raise the ghosts in order to find out what happened. However, they're all unable to. When Harrow and Gideon inspect the key a little bit more, Gideon realizes that the key has all the same symbols as a hidden door she had seen earlier. They go to unlock it, and it's essentially an office, but they are able to obtain some information from it. Not all of the potential lictors are having as much success, though, and Dulcelina proposes a trade. She is unable to perform a task, but she is willing to share the solution with Harrow if she shares the key. It turns out that in order to pass this test, Harrow must siphon energy from Gideon, which almost kills both of them, but they manage it. There comes a boiling point between the houses that results in a duel after someone reveals that the keys are a limited resource. They also realize that one of the cavaliers is missing, so Gideon and the teenagers from one of the houses goes to find them. It ends badly with both of the teenagers dead. After a fight between Harrow and Gideon, Gideon decides to accept an offer of tea with the eighth house. It turns out that the eighth house wants the ninth house completely wiped out and views them as liars and dishonorable. Luckily, Gideon does manage to escape with her life and the keys. Harrow decides that it's finally time to tell Gideon the truth about the ninth house. Harrow was essentially created from the deaths of 200 plus children. And when Harrow was a child, she was interested in opening the locked tomb. Gideon had revealed this to her parents, and her parents committed suicide. This revelation brings Harrow and Gideon a bit closer. The death of the fifth house is not forgotten, though, and the third house did what was essentially an autopsy and found a key inside of one of them. Ninth, sixth, and eighth houses go to find third house, and they find Ianthe, a newly born lictor. She had eaten the soul of her cavalier. There is a fight. Everything escalates quickly after that, and we find out one of the necromancers is not who they say they are, and they are there to stop the trials. So, what happens after that? Does she succeed? Spoilers ahead. Marissa, how did you feel about this book?
Well, I liked this book. It was weird. The writing was kind of difficult to follow at times. And for a significant portion of the book, I would say even probably all the way up until the end, I didn't totally understand everything that was going on. So I wish that I had a better understanding of things. And I think there's a lot of stuff that we weren't given information about that could have enhanced the story. Not just my understanding of it, but like actual story. However, I think Gideon's dialogue is hysterical. And so much of what I highlighted in this book was just her being sarcastic. And I really, and so this book was just basically a murder mystery in space. And I enjoyed that aspect. I used to read murder mysteries all the time. And so trying to figure out who did what and who our villain was and things like that was fun for me and surprising because typically I feel like I can figure that stuff out and I could not in this story. And I also felt like the necromancy aspect, although I wish that it had been explored a little bit more, was interesting and different when we've read books that feature necromancy in the past. Feel like it's all kind of the same. And the people doing things with skeletons or reanimating bodies or things like that. It's not quite as descriptive and diverse as what we saw in this story. And so there's a lot of different types of necromancy that we got to read about, which I enjoyed. I also liked seeing Harrow and Gideon eventually work together and stop hating each other so much. But I feel like that's balanced with I just wish that there had been a whole lot more development of the world and some plot points. I
Yeah.
don't know. I feel like at a certain point, I just kind of settled into knowing that I wasn't going to get answers to most of the questions that I had, and then I it just accepted it and settled in. So, yeah. What did you think, Vicky?
I didn't like it, Marissa. At all. I'm so sorry. It's got such good reviews. It looks so cool. But there was so much, like, it just, there was so much missing, right?
Yeah.
And it frustrated me to no end. And on top of that, there are so many side characters, right? But they
Yes.
all have like multiple names. So that was confusing to me, right? That was confusing to me. And then I just wish, so it's cool that they have different types of necromancy. That's cool. I liked that idea, but we didn't get to see it that much. We didn't get it
Yeah.
really explained that much. At one point, one of them literally eats part of a living human being, and that's just glossed over. It's like, what?
Yeah.
There, and I felt like I didn't get answers to any of my questions, or they were very poorly answered. I mean, they set up, or the author set up a lot of things, but then didn't explain them, right? Like Lictors, she brought it up really early in the book and doesn't explain exactly what it is until over 100 pages later.
Yeah.
And that's frustrating because I'm working on this assumption. So when Harrow invites Gideon, it's like, hey, be my bodyguard, right? Gideon says, oh, well, I don't want to be part of her like rise to fascist power. So in my head, I was thinking, oh, they're like competing to be some sort of leader. But no, they're competing to be the emperor's sidekicks, I guess.
Yeah.
I wasn't able to overlook not getting answers and not having like an in-depth understanding of what was happening. And
Yeah.
it made it hard for me to read.
Yeah. There is a glossary in this story. It's at the end. And a lot of the I even by the end of the book, there were still a lot of questions that didn't get answered for me. And so maybe that shows up in future books because this is part of a series. Maybe those questions get answered later on. But by the end of this book, I still had so many unanswered questions that I don't feel a ton of motivation to move on to the next story either.
Yeah, and I feel like some things were stuck in there and never picked up again. Like that note that Gideon finds that has her name
Yes,
on it.
it has her name on it. What is that?
That was never, I mean, I think it was brought up at one point. She shows it to somebody.
Yeah, she gives it to Sextus
That's right.
Palamedes from House Six, which but we never pick that back up again, and it seems kind of significant. If I found my name on a note that's 10,000 years old, I would either think, whoa, there just happened to be another Gideon, but that seems really oddly coincidental, doesn't it? We should explore that some more. Also, what about Gideon's mother? Because I feel like a lot of detail was devoted to, or at least some was devoted to, her parentage and how strange it was. But we don't find out anything else. And then when you couple those things with the knowledge that Gideon's kind of special, 200, like she was supposed to die. Gideon lived, and Harrow's parents resented and were fearful of her for the rest of her life because of it. So she survived. Why? She's obviously special in some way. Like what's the story there?
Yeah, there was so much that could have been done, and so many things that were referenced that just really weren't expanded on. Like one of the other characters mentions that their mom was outside of the rim. What? Where is the rim? Where are
What does
these
that
kids?
mean?
What? I was like, okay, there's a war going on. What is this war about? Who are they fighting? Are they fighting each other?
Yes.
I don't know
Yeah.
what's happening.
Why?
I
Why is what? What is the war?
just want to know what's happening, Marissa.
Right? Well, and so I think that's where I didn't read, and this is the problem with having all of that extra stuff at the end of the book. I didn't read it. I read a little bit of the glossary, but I didn't. I'm not. If you can't put it in the story, why is it there? I just find that really like a glossary is meant to be A helpful, and so I'm thinking of Karen Marie Moning's books, right? Her Fever series, Karen Marie Moning, she wrote the Fever series. It's like 12 books long. And in the back of it, there's a very extensive glossary to help you keep track of all of the things that have happened up to that point in details, the monsters, the main characters, and things like that. It is a reference where you can go back and look at all of these other things, like how I would imagine a glossary is supposed to be used. The things that are in that are things that you could go back and pull, you can find in the other stories in the other books, right?
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't put stuff in the glossary until like you've already met
Until
them
you've,
in the book,
yes.
and it's already explained in the book, right?
Yes.
Like
Yeah, it's explained
Adams.
in the book.
Yeah. And then she puts it back there just a refresher, you know?
Yes, in case you've forgotten something, or when the books were coming out, if she was spitting out one book every year, every other year, every 2 years, it's something you could go back and use as a reference. It's a reference. It's things that have already been explained in the story. That is not this. This is like a glossary and a whole like roster and descriptor of all of the other people that are showing up in here with information that does not ever show up in the actual plot of the book. It's all extra stuff. That's hard. I don't want to have to read the story and then get to all of that stuff at the end after I've already read the story. I either needed it at the beginning or I needed it to be in the plot.
I was so annoyed.
Yeah. It's frustrating.
It was really frustrating, especially because, I mean, you know, you said you kind of like got into it after you released needing
Just
answers.
give up.
I couldn't let it go. Then I got to the end and I was just like, seriously? This, it's here?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought it was going to start out so well because, you know, she had a list of all the people in the front.
Yeah.
Like, okay, we're starting out on a positive note. It didn't go great.
Yeah.
But
Yeah. I was able to still enjoy the book. I had a good time reading it. But I can see how if you didn't just give up on the idea of getting any answers, you would be really frustrated. Yeah.
and
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's also so it's a murder mystery, but I didn't even really get that vibe from it because I felt like I was trying to catch up the whole time almost because they would say so and so was like Abigail and whoever the guy was, right? They died. They were the fifth house. So they said they died, and I'm like, oh, who are these people? So I have to go back and see the fifth house. Or they're referencing like the necromancer from the third house. Whose name is that? Let me go. It wasn't a fun read.
Yeah. What I think part of that may be from as well is all of these people, the Cavaliers and their necromancers, they get to this planet and are given really vague instructions for what they're there for, too. So there's this guy, his name is Teacher. I don't really know what his deal is. And there's two priests. I don't really know what their deal is either, but they are running the show here along with a bunch of reanimated skeletons who we later find out are revenants. And Teacher basically gives them no instructions for figuring out how they're supposed to become lictors. He just says, don't open any locked doors without asking permission. Okay. So our participants in the story, they don't really know what's going on either. They're also trying to figure it out. So maybe part of this is that it's supposed to be intentionally vague. But I that's hard. And some readers don't really like things like that. Maybe a part of it's also just that it's really different from what we usually read when we come to sci-fi and fantasy. Most of the sci-fi stuff that we read is like alien romance. So I don't know. It would be nice for there to be more information about when and where this is set as well, right? Because you can't really, like, is it set in the past? Is it set in the future?
I know it was
Way in the future?
I know, like they reference pizza and electric toothbrushes, but then also they didn't know what a bath was. What?
They use a sanitizer for a shower and it takes like 20 minutes or 20 seconds for them to get clean. So that sounds like it's set sometime in the future. We also have bathtubs in the same space. I don't know. It's really odd.
It's confusing, and it just even like it just took a while for everything to even get going, you know?
It did take some time for things to kind of get kicked off.
Yeah.
What's her name? Oh, Gideon spent a good bit of time complaining about Harrow and figuring out how to use a rapier. So there was also that. And that's where, so in that part of the story, we do get a little bit of description just on like what's going on in Ninth House and Harrow's history and things like that. So we get a little bit of like character development and just information there. But there were still just so many questions that didn't get answered.
Yeah, I agree. And it was boring. It took me 3.5 hours to get through 150 pages because I kept falling asleep. I had to prop myself up a certain way so that my phone was hanging off, and if it fell, it would wake me up.
So I started reading this book like 2 weeks ago, and did not power read it like you did. Like I read probably 100 pages of it last week and then finished the rest of it this week. So I can see how if you were power, like it's kind of a slog in the first part, especially. Also, and this is fine. There's nothing wrong with this, but I always feel weirdly accomplished when I've read a book that has no romance and no sex in it. And that's this book.
Yeah, this book was marketed very poorly, I guess.
It's just, I don't know. It's different from what I thought.
Yeah, well, because it's marketed as like lesbians, lesbian necromancers in space, right?
Yes,
I
that
think.
is the tagline. That is on the cover of the book, I think.
And we basically from that just have necromancers. We got one out of those three things.
Is this a sci-fi book or is this a fantasy book?
Because
Can it be both?
I mean, so I did look up the differences, right? So sci-fi is typically set in like the real world in some sort of dystopian society sort of thing with more technology, right? That's your typical sci-fi book. Whereas fantasy is a whole new world, right? Everything, they create their own rules, whereas in sci-fi, they're still restricted by regular rules, you know.
So then this is more
Both.
fantasy.
Yeah, I would. Yeah.
So then I would agree if that's the case that lesbian romance or necromancers, lesbian romancers in space. Lesbian necromancers in space doesn't really fit. Also, is Harrow a lesbian?
Don't know.
We don't get in like any information, I don't feel like, about her sexuality. Gideon is a lesbian,
Yeah, and
but
even
she's not a necromancer.
right. It seemed like it was going to be a major part of the book. It was marketed, and then it wasn't. So it gave the idea that there was going to be, at least to me, I read that and was like, oh, maybe there'll be some romance. There wasn't, which was fine. I really wasn't expecting that much going into it because I think it is YA, or it should be YA if it's not classified as YA. So and even with the necromancer part, there was so much there that they could have done. Like, you know,
Oh,
okay,
yeah. Okay.
so.
So here's where in the product details on the Amazon page for its ranking, it ranks number 31 in space opera science fiction. I don't know what that means, but also sword and sorcery fantasy books, which seems pretty on point. And then LGBTQ plus romance books. So there's that. I really don't. There's not a lot of romance. There's not any romance.
No, I don't enter. I mean, there's some flirtation.
There is flirtation. Oh, there's a lot of flirtation with
Yeah.
Gideon. Can you imagine Gideon, 18-year-old? I don't know if we still call 18-year-olds teenagers, but hey, 18-year-old woman on a planet with a bunch of new people after having spent most of her life with skeletons, Harrow, who she hates, Crux and Aglamaine, who hate her, and Harrow's dead parents. And then she gets to first house where there are people like all the hormones.
I know.
There are finally people around for her to be attracted to. I thought it was hilarious that every time she ended up in a room with someone from another house who was like, there were people in bathing suits at one point or like shorts, she's just like, ah, hormones.
Yes. So there was cute flirtation and stuff, and that was funny. She was always like sweating, I think, right? Didn't she say that? But if Harrow is supposed to be the main, I guess, love interest in this, did not get that vibe.
No, that didn't come across at all.
No, not at
Harrow
all.
is terrible.
Through the whole book, I'm sorry, she just.
Most of it, yep. There are a few moments where it's like, oh, maybe she's not that bad.
Well, she says it's so sweet. I think when she's revealing all of the information, she says something like, "You are my only friend. I am undone without you."
Yes.
That's so sweet. But then she just says a jerk again. So,
At the very, very end, she has redeeming moments. She offers to, or she encourages Gideon and Camilla at that point, at the very end, to make a break for it, and she'll hold off the big bad guy, or the villain, while they escape. So we've got some sacrificial lamb moments, and that's pretty big for Harrow, who is generally pretty selfish and seems unwilling to help other people. Yeah, she gets a tiny, tiny bit better at the end of the book.
Yeah, and I'm
And, you know, she's had, I would say, some traumatic things happen in her life. So maybe part of this is just her trying to protect herself. Doesn't absolve all the bad behavior, though.
No, but even her tragic backstory was confusing, right? So, in order for her to be conceived, they had to kill all of the like children that were currently in the ninth house just for her to be conceived. So there's, and obviously Gideon for some reason didn't die. That's a big Gideon thing. So she grows up kind of, and she gets interested in the locked tomb. I'm really confused as to whether or not she unlocked it or not and started the apocalypse. Very confused because at one point it sounded like that's what happened, but then she was talking later on about just watching that girl in ice, and I don't know for sure. And then her parents like kill themselves in front of her. So,
Well, she was supposed to kill herself too.
and yeah, and she was supposed to kill herself too, but couldn't bring herself to do it because that's, yeah,
That's a lot for a child.
that is a lot. And also when I was first reading that, the way it was written, so it says that she was found holding rope, and I assumed she had killed her parents and made it look like a suicide.
I totally thought that too.
Okay. Well, it wasn't just me then. Good.
Again, this would just be really helpful in terms of knowing the backstory of this entire world. The person in the locked tomb is allegedly the Emperor's or the Necrolord Prime. I don't know if these are the same people. It's hard to discern, but we'll call it the same people. The deity, the god. Their enemy, their big bad enemy, who was entombed on the planet of the ninth house. And they were supposed to, the people on this planet were supposed to wall themselves into the tomb and die. And they didn't. They built the tomb and decided not to wall themselves off and die and chose to live instead. Which is apparently a problem for the people that belong to the eighth house. They think that's not what should have happened. And so We have that. We there's a girl in a tomb on this planet. It sounds like Harrow may have started the apocalypse. Would it really be such a bad thing? This sounds like a terrible place to live.
I know, I'm all in for an interesting apocalypse, so yeah. Let's do
Let's go for it. Yeah,
it.
and so then so we have this locked tomb, also known as the ninth house, get like no information about the girl that's in the tomb. So then I wonder, it's a girl, is it really, is she really the greatest, most powerful enemy of the emperor? Is this real? Like, what if the emperor is actually the bad person? The person in the tomb is the good person.
Yeah, and
What if it's all a lie?
we've been reading books that just mess with our heads, right? Because that's what happened to some of our other books recently. But yes, I agree. We don't know whether the Emperor is good or bad, or even what the general consensus about him really is. Nobody ever seemed, I mean, they call him a god, but you can call somebody a god and them still be bad, right? So they're, and nobody seems to really be like, he's bad, he's good, he's just here. Yeah. It was just, it's hard to know anything. But yeah, I really would have liked to know more about the different types of necromancy.
Yeah, there were so many different types. I still don't totally understand what Ionthe from the third house. I that part, it came out really fast and it was kind of confusing. I don't understand why she chews on people and eats hair and skin to create her craft. Also, that's is that cannibalism?
No, so it's flesh necromancy, and hold on, it's also called in the book animophilia.
Animophiliac.
Thank you, animophiliac. Yes, so that's what she is. Why? I don't know.
I
Also, they
think that
only use that
she...
term once without describing. Oh, I was so annoyed that that came up, and I was like, oh, great, we know what she. Nope, just okay, wasn't described.
I think it would have been it, I would have liked to have known more about the other types of necromancy that people use. Because we get some descriptions of some of it, but we don't get a lot, and we don't get it for every house.
Right. We get a little bit of the eighth house, I think, right? Where
Soul siphoning.
yeah, the siphoning, and it could make his like cavalier go mad, or it kills their brain or whatever. Yeah. No.
Yeah, so we got them. I can't remember what Sextus Palamedes, that was House Six. I can't remember what his was. We got nothing from 2, 4, or 5. But we got like a little bit. We know that Abigail Pent, she uses like spirit magic or something, but we don't really get to see that in action.
Yeah, it's disappointing. Somebody I saw in one of the reviews, because after I read it, I was like, there has to be other people who agree with me. I can't be the only person who absolutely couldn't stand this book. But yeah, somebody said one of the reviews I read was that the author is doing more showing. Or doing more telling than showing, which I felt like was happening, even with the fights, because Gideon's just kind of looking on in some of these. Okay, so the goal, right, is to, I guess, complete all of these challenges using different types of necromancy, right? That's what you said.
So from what I understand, to become lictors, our cavaliers and our necromancers have to work together basically to solve puzzles to or complete really the experiments that the original lictors used to become lictors, right? I think that ends up supporting. So Sextus Palamedes from Sixth House, he Sixth House had a theory about there being like a mega theorem. Basically, everybody works together to create this thing, and this thing ends up being using necromancy for the necromancer to like absorb their cavalier to become super powerful. Because necromancy, for all of our necromancers, they're described as being small, like thin, gangly, sweating blood. Necromancy seems to take a pretty significant toll on their body, whereas their cavalier exists to protect them, basically, to fend off anyone who might make them vulnerable to attack. And so, what, and this is what Ianthe from Third House discovers at the end of the book. She eats her cavalier, basically. She absorbs the essence of his soul. So you have the necromancy power, and you absorb your cavalier's abilities so you can defend yourself as well. So that's what all of these challenges that they have to go through, and finding the keys and understanding what actually happened in this, what's described as like a haunted palace, like 10,000 years ago. That's their mission, basically. They figure out. And with that, we have some mystical being, either a ghost that's haunting the palace, or a murderer amongst our contestants or characters, who is sort of one by one eliminating people from houses in really gruesome and horrible ways.
Yeah. See, the other thing with that, right, is somebody wrote in blood on the wall, right? Like death to the fourth house and then sweet dreams, right? Ooh, what, who? This is the ghost person doing this? And then we don't see this ever come back up. No more bloody words anywhere.
So I do think that feels plot holey almost. Feels a little bit confusing, because we find out later that the person who is committing the murders is, her name is Cytheria the First, who either, I couldn't tell if she body snatched Dulcinea from House Seven, or if she just assumed her role and pretended to be Dulcinea because nobody had ever seen her before. But basically, Cytheria is manipulating everybody into thinking that she is from House Seven, when actually she's one of the last remaining original lictors that's supports or that works for the Emperor. And so what I assumed was that she was the one who was orchestrating the murders and doing the weird, bloody paintings on the wall. But it doesn't ever get brought up. So is that actually what's happening? And if that's the case, is she just trying to make them think that the place is haunted?
Yeah, also, don't they put people outside of her door to guard her pretty much all the time?
Well, yeah, but she, well, not all the time, but also she's just like super powerful too. So maybe she can, I don't know, do, we don't know what her abilities are
That's true.
because she is a lictor. So who knows what she can do and is capable of. I don't think she has guards with her all the time.
I
I
thought she
do.
had someone with her. Like, because they say, oh, go guard her a couple times.
Well, so at one point, teacher sits with her. The priest sits with her at one point as well. And Harrow and Sextus and Camilla, his cavalier, they go and guard her at one point, while Gideon and the two kids from Fourth House go down into the facility. And that's where Isaac from Fourth House is murdered by the monster that Cytheria created, and later comes back in the last part of the book to fight. So that's why I assumed that she was the one who was the ghost, right? Because it's the same monster that she brings back.
Yeah. Okay.
Which means that she can do some kind of magic shit without having to actually be present.
Do we know why the lictors died off?
No.
I
We
know
don't.
that before becoming one.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that seems like standard question you would ask in a job interview. Sure.
Yeah.
What happened to everybody else? They died, which we find out in the epilogue. Yeah. And that also brings us to why Cytherea is there, right? Because we find out at the end, Cytherea the first, original Lictor, served the emperor. Her role in this whole thing has been to kill everybody, basically, so that the emperor doesn't have a choice but to come down to the surface of First House and figure out what is going on, at which point she plans to kill him. But we don't know why.
Yeah. Why is she mad at him? Does she want to die? Like maybe she's tired of living? I don't know.
I think she's pissed about something
Yes.
because she makes a comment about how she and the emperor makes a comment too about how she was like the steady one, the level-headed one, the most, and he wishes that she would have come to him instead of, I guess, murdering everybody. I don't
Oh
know.
yeah, that's right. He wishes she would have just talked to him and they could have sorted it out.
Yeah.
Skimmed that epilogue.
Yeah. And also there's a so in near the end of the book, when Ianthe figures out that she can absorb her cavalier, in that scene, there's the words in bold, "You lied to us," painted on the wall. What does that mean? Is that the emperor lying to them? Who lied to whom? But also, she makes it so when Cytherea introduces herself, basically. And this, I was completely surprised by this. I was not, I mean, I figured there had to be something going on with Dulcinea for her to be the least involved in everything for, but for all of this bad stuff to keep happening and for no, it's like, if no one thinks she's a suspect, she's got to be the number one suspect. I don't know. I wasn't expecting her to be the body snatch villain, but she makes a comment about her ne so when Cytherea is introducing herself, really, she says, "I am the vengeance of the 10 billion." Who is that?
Maybe all the people that they had to kill.
Yeah.
That
That's
is
a lot of
amazing.
people.
You just, there are so many questions unanswered and so many questions that lead to more questions. And
Yeah.
it was tiring.
Yeah. So, like, why does she want to kill the emperor? Is it because he's actually a villain and not great? Have they all been lied to? Maybe. But also, Cytherea was like super brutal because at the end, she's fighting Ianthe and she disarms her literally. Like, she cuts her arm off and she makes a comment about how she plans to cut off her arms and her legs and use her as a battery for energy, which is terrible.
Oh, that like fight with Ianthe and the I don't know the
Silas,
other
it was
yeah
Silas,
sure
yeah.
Silas. What the hell?
It was wild. It
I
was so
don't know
weird.
what happened. That's like just my mantra for this book. That's gonna be my review. I don't know what happened,
Yeah.
but she like gets away in a pit of goo or something.
Yeah. So she uses her flesh magic to make a fleshy, impenetrable cocoon. And Silas uses his siphoning abilities and unfortunately corrupts Colum, his personal battery, to fight her. And he dies. But it's really bizarre how she fights, because she eventually comes out of her fleshy cocoon. But then disappears into a puddle of blood and then comes out of another puddle of blood. So is the puddle of blood like a portal? Does it let her transport?
When you were a kid, did you ever watch Alice Mack? Or
No.
Alex Mack? She turns into a puddle.
Oh, okay. Does it
Kind
work
of.
like a portal?
No, she just is. She can just like slither along in this, like, she's like a silvery puddle.
Oh,
I
okay.
don't know, but that's what made me think of. And
That's
that's what I
fair.
pictured in my head, this like, it's just a puddle.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe she is just a puddle of blood and can move around like that. If you mop it up, it's does she die? hair dries out? Like, is she dead? What happens to the petal hole? Does she disperse? What? I feel like this is a little bit problematic. I don't know, because she pops up later from a puddle. Maybe she is the puddle.
Be surprising, I guess, right? Why can't they shape shift? They can do anything else.
What?
Oh,
Yeah.
add that in there.
Who? I don't know. I don't know. It was weird. This whole fight scene was weird, and poor Gollum.
I
Gollum
know.
is the battery for Silas to do the siphoning. He gets possessed. His eyeballs disappear and turn into mouths. I
What?
don't like that at all. That hap There's so the villain on a show on Netflix, and I forget what it's called, but it's a fantasy show. He's got mouths for eyeballs. I don't like that.
No, I didn't like it in the book. I don't think I'm gonna watch a TV show with it in it. That was not my favorite description.
Nope. I don't like that at all.
Was, and that's a sort one of the things that I have in our notes that I was talking about was Gideon is super hyped up to be this amazing fighter and stuff. Which, okay, yeah, she's good, but we don't really get to see her fight that much.
No, she does some fighting at the end. She fights Magnus and makes him feel bad.
Yeah. But yeah, that
And
was,
she
yeah.
fights Nabirius. Well, and I think part of that, well, at least my assumption with part of it with the rapier, is she's not trying to get into a bunch of fights because she's not great with a rapier.
That's true.
Right? She
Yes.
goes for it at the end when she's got her sword.
Yeah. I just it seemed like such a I don't know. You know, she I just I felt like she
Yeah.
was just standing on the sideline watching all of like on the sidelines watching all of this go down.
Yeah. Well, I could see standing on the sidelines of this fight because it's weird, and I'm not going to borrow somebody else's problems if I don't have, maybe they'll just kill each other and we can call it, right?
Yeah.
So in this scene, I'm not going to fight anyone with mouths for eyes. I'm not getting in that fight.
I pictured her like just eating popcorn, you know that meme
Yeah.
where it's a person eating popcorn. I pictured that as that fight was going on.
Yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of other people in the room. It's not just her.
Yeah,
It's
no, it's not.
Harrow, Sextus, and his cavalier Camilla. Coronabeth is still there, just crying in the corner. There's other people watching this.
Yeah.
Also not get I don't know. It was a weird fight. I wouldn't get involved in this either.
I wouldn't get involved in it. I would have just been like, I know you're not gonna, at the very beginning, you're not gonna give me a fair fight. I am gonna go on that shuttle. And
Yeah.
then I guess I would have died because didn't Crux blowed up?
Yeah.
Yeah. But still, wouldn't have to go through all this.
Well, I mean, so I know that Dulcinea ended up being our villain. Her strategy is probably the one that I would have taken. No, she's got blood cancer. She's dying. She's just hanging out. She's reading books, sunning herself. I would let everybody else do the work. Because I know that my chances of surviving this are low. This is just a vacation. I just came because I had no choice.
Well, she mentions it's interesting that like her people viewed like she would have just been put away to die
Yeah.
somewhere, right?
Yeah.
So she wanted to do something else. And also what I found really interesting here is that she mentions that one of the most powerful necromancers are ones that are close to death.
Yeah.
And that seems to be relatively well known. So I'm curious as to why other characters also weren't like, huh, should be super powerful. Because
Yeah.
I had that thought. I was like, well, I mean, what?
Yeah.
And she did the wait, was she was well, it wasn't actually her, I guess, but her cavalier, whose name also started with a P, I believe, was just dead. He was just a walking corpse, right?
Yeah. That was her magic. She could do that.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Protesilaus
Yeah.
is his name, and she just reanimated him completely.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I would like to know more about that. I wonder if that's her magic or if it's like whatchamacallit's magic, the Lictor's magic.
Oh, Cytheria.
Yeah. I don't know. Either way, that would have been cool to explore reanimation like that. Oh, also, I pictured in that first fight between Gideon and Harrow, right back on Ninth House, with all the bones, that it was basically like Mickey Mouse in the Fantasia, right, where he's getting all of the buckets and he tries and he like slices one and like two more pop up and he keeps doing that, and then there's just all of these like brooms with buckets and it overflows. And I just pictured that with bones, because Steven mentioned later like all like she just used like bone shards to get all of these other bones to turn into skeletons. And so I just pictured like as Gideon broke down a skeleton, three more popped up in its place.
I could see it. I
Cool.
could see that. Harrow takes. She really tries to do this by herself, which I get. I don't like team projects either. You know, sucks to work with another person sometimes. So I get it, wanting to do the whole thing by yourself. She realizes, though, that she can't. And I liked it when they started working together, because up until that point, Gideon's just kind of walking around, social, not really socializing, just hanging out, and people are talking at her, bored, wandering. And she realizes, like, oh, we're gonna have to do this together. So I appreciate the teamwork, because Harrow gets a little bit more likable when they do actually start working together.
Yeah, and we also see Harrow have some reservations about things, right? She didn't want Gideon to just go into that room, right, and fight that. And Gideon's reasoning is like his arms look like swords, which I also would not, so that was somebody's reasoning. I would also encourage them to stay out. And then as well as siphoning her magic, she was hesitant there. I don't know if it was necessarily because it was Gideon or because it wasn't like it's kind of more frowned upon magic. You know, we do see she has some moral values going on here.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I enjoyed it when they started working together. The scene where Harrow has to basically put Gideon in a lot of pain so that she can get the next key.
Sure.
And then we see Harrow like actually be concerned about her.
Yes, and she actually calls her Gideon
Yes,
for
yeah.
one. And I actually really liked the line after that where Gideon says, like, haha, you didn't call me. Wait, did she say girdle or griddle?
Griddle.
Griddle. Okay, I couldn't remember. Griddle. And then died. And I know she didn't actually die, but I liked that line. It
Yeah.
made me laugh a little bit.
Yeah. They had some good moments together.
Yeah, they did.
So it we see a little bit. I still don't find any romance in this story, but we do see like hesitant friendship, maybe. Or maybe it's like reluctant friendship,
Yeah.
because both of them eventually make comments about how important they are to each other.
Is it like a trauma bond, though?
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, they traumatized each other, but
Yeah.
know.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
don't know. It's good to see it. And I don't think we would believe at the end when Harrow and Gideon are talking about sacrificing themselves for each other. We would believe that if we didn't have at least some of these moments somewhere along the way in the story.
Yeah. Yeah. We needed a little bit of it.
Part of this, and this is what's frustrating, we hit a little bit of a miscommunication or the lack of communication trope with some of these things, because some of this stuff happens because Harrow doesn't communicate with Gideon all of the information that she's found out about some of the other characters.
Yes, because Gideon's really upset with her when the twins di or not the twins, gosh, the teenagers die.
Yeah.
And finds out that Harrow knew what could happen or what was going on and didn't say anything to her.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. Gideon is interested in Dulcinea. You said that's how you say it? That's how I'm
Yeah.
going to say it. That's what I'm going with.
Okay.
And so they've had this like flirtation going on, it's been a little cute, right? And then Gideon finds out that one from the sixth house is
Sextus.
right? And Dulcelina are kind of a thing. They've been in contact for years, so there's something going on there, right? And Gideon's response, she like falls to the ground in hysterics. And I think that's actually the description too. Like she becomes hysterical and falls on the ground and then apologizes profusely, which okay. And she calls herself a homewrecker and stuff, even though nothing happened between any of them. Like this, nothing happened at all. I just.
It was pretty dramatic.
It
I
was.
think we can chalk some of this up to her being 18 years old
Come,
and having no socialization.
okay. I'm gonna. I'm yes. She had no socialization, but that's pretty. She just like falls on the floor.
Yeah.
I don't. Yeah.
Being a teenager is pretty hard.
It's true.
But also, I mean, so I think part of this was just that Gideon really wanted to be liked. She never had friends. No one has ever been kind to her until she got to this terrible place. And Sextus was actually like kind to her and told her that, she didn't need an adult to tell her that as an 11-year-old, it wasn't her fault that Harrow's parents committed suicide. And he's actually like, she's actually met some people who are nice to her, and she never really had that before. So I think, like, I could see if I were in that situation, I met this person, they were nice to me where no one ever was, and I feel like I may have betrayed them. And the only person I've ever spent time with my age who is someone who repeatedly tortured me and gave me a bad time. I mean, I would be worried about upsetting them too. I would feel bad probably. I don't think I would throw myself on the floor. I have never done that before. But I don't know. I could see it. I don't know.
Yeah, it was.
It was a lot.
It was. She had a lot of feelings, I
She
guess.
did.
And yeah, a lot of feelings.
Yeah. Yep. So this then leads to Sextus, her seeking out Sextus. He's gone to see Dulcinea. He reveals that he knows that Dulcinea is not really Dulcinea, the person that he's exchanged letters with. And he uses his magic to speed up the cancer that's killing her. He blows himself up, and that acts as the catalyst for all of the events of the last part of this book, which means the unveiling of Cytherea the First, the destruction of this palace thing, and a big battle, which results in Gideon getting hurt. Camilla, who is still alive, getting hurt. Harrow trying to save them and forming the bone protection thing, cocoon. And offering to sacrifice herself, basically, so that Gideon and Camilla can get away. Which is a big, big move for Harrow, considering how terrible she was at the beginning of this story.
Yeah. But that's not what happens.
No, that's not what happens. Gideon says, "You know what? We're not going to do that. We would never make it. It would be a waste of all of our lives." And she throws herself onto a pointy railing thing and dies so that Hera will absorb her soul like Ionte did with her, or Ionte, yeah, did with her cavalier. And become so that Harrow can become Elector, which is what she wanted all along, what Harrow wanted all along.
I feel like that would be a painful and maybe slow death.
Yeah.
It depends on what gets punctured.
Yeah.
Yeah, it depends on what gets punctured.
It does seem like, I mean, if we were choosing ways that we go, that wouldn't be my first choice, you know?
Yeah.
Throwing yourself on a pointy fence.
Yeah.
There's worse. There's worse ways to go.
This was a unique way. I wouldn't have thought of it.
No.
So there's that.
There is that. Yeah. And then I totally can't remember if Harrow ends up killing Cytheria. It seems like she does. Then she passes out and wakes up on the Emperor's ship.
Yeah, and it's kind of a little sad. So when she's fighting off Cytheria or whatever, she says, like, Gideon's talking to her in her head, right? But then when she's with the Emperor, she can't hear her anymore. And I was like, that's kind of sad.
It is kind of sad.
But at the same time, I was just so glad to be done with the book.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I felt worse about the death of the kids from the fourth house, Isaac and Jean Mary and Magnus and Abigail Pent, just because they I just felt, oh, they were so young. Those kids, they were so young. I felt worse about them than I did about Gideon's death here at the end. I felt more just bad for Gideon in that this was not what she wanted to happen. She wanted to be a soldier, to live independently of Harrow, and to not, like, once she did what she wanted, what Harrow wanted her to do, to be free of her. And that's not what happened. You know that she chose to go this way, and there's power in having choice, but I just like a happy ending. And Gideon did not get a happy ending.
She was doomed from the start.
Yep. I mentioned earlier, Gideon's commentary was my favorite part of this book. And so now I'm going to read some quotes from some things that she said that made me laugh. She calls Harrow a desiccated mummy of hate. She describes Petro Silaeus, who is Dulcinea's cavalier, as having upsetting biceps. She says he looked like a collection of lemons in a sack. To Harrow, she says, "Your parents must have been so relieved to die."
So I do really like some of her witty things like that, right? That you listed, but a lot of her stuff though, like was a lot of just teenage brattiness.
She's
No.
a
I
teenager.
know, but I didn't want to read it.
She's 18. Harrow is 17.
I know, but
Th thus the drama.
The Office, they quote Mean Girls in it at one point. I mean, because she did have good comebacks like that, and then she would have something that just falls really, really flat. Like, that's what she said.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah.
come
Yeah.
on. I, yeah.
I don't know. I just really enjoyed. She says, "Now we kick her ass until candy comes out." I like that. She calls Isaac. So Isaac's death was terrible because he gets impaled by like 50 spines. But she says Isaac had been made into a big teenage colander, which is terrible. She calls Harrow her tenebrous overlord, my midnight Haggett, my crepuscular queen. She
Yes.
got some witty words.
She did. She did. Felt, yeah, she did. But I found her character kind of grating sometimes.
Yeah.
So, but teenagers,
Yeah.
I guess. Soft
Teenagers.
talks about teenagers. I do think.
So overall, still a lot more questions than answers.
Yeah.
I feel good about crossing this one off the TBR pile.
I'm so disappointed.
I'm not.
I know. The cover just made it look so great.
Yeah, the covers kick ass.
Right?
She's like a
She looks like
ginger
such a.
with a sword, face mask, black clothes. I mean, she looks like the punk rock friend that everybody wants.
Yep, she does. Well, I am also glad that I crossed this off a list and will never need to wonder anymore what I might be missing. Do you have any favorite quotes?
Yeah, so this is what Hera says to Gideon when they're getting ready to take the fourth house down into the facility where they eventually die. She says, "Never work with children, Griddle. Their prefrontal cortexes aren't developed." And I like this because we talk about this all the time. And I love seeing it acknowledged.
But it's funny because they also aren't, like, their prefrefrontal cortexes aren't developed either. They're all under 25,
and they won't be. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Nobody is. Well, that's not true. Some of them are older than 25, but these people aren't.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you?
So I had, if you do not find yourself a galaxy, it is not so bad to find yourself a star. It's very pretty imagery. I enjoyed that. I really liked the imagery behind that and the sentiment behind it.
I do think this is not as books with necromancy go. I really, and if you like books with necromancy, listeners, Rin Chupeco, we've talked about these books before.
Yes.
Rin Chupeco wrote the Bone Witch series, and it is outstanding. It's more, I would say, high fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a trilogy. It's so, so good.
It really is. Yeah, when I got to the end, I was like, yeah, Rin Chupeco did better.
Yeah, and it does have a lot of representation, too. There's a trans character.
Yep.
And lesbians as well. We have some gay characters. We also have a lot more romance in the story.
Yeah. Ah, that was so good. I kind of... Oh, your note two is you're thinking about rereading them.
Yeah, I think about, because I've read them twice now, I could do it again. I really enjoyed them. They were so good. So if necromancy is your vibe,
definitely pick up.
Yeah, these are a good option too.
Yeah.
Yep. You got anything else you want to say?
No.
Okay. Well, that wraps up Gideon the Ninth by Tamsin Muir. Join us next time. We'll be discussing Serpent and the Wings of Night by Carissa Broadbent. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to Literary Quest. We hope you enjoyed our episode. If you'd like to follow us on social media, we can be found at Literary Quest Podcast on Instagram or Facebook. You're also welcome to share your thoughts and ideas with us via email at literaryquestpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again.